We're in Matthew chapter 2, lesson number 2 in the life of Christ. We're dealing with the events that followed upon the birth of Jesus. We're talking about those who came to visit him. Specifically, we're talking about the Magi, or the wise men, who came to visit Jesus. And again, in what circumstance did the Magi come to visit Jesus? I'm sorry? Chronologically, again, put it in context. Was it at his birth, after his birth?
Oh, right.
Yeah. Right. Somewhere between, maybe 40 days up to 2 years. We don't know. But it was not at the birth. And we simply, again, want to keep the right chronology in mind as we study his life and reflect, again, the truths that God has revealed to us. All right, Luke, we'll get back to Luke chapter 2. I don't know if we'll make it there tonight, but shortly before we end this lesson number 2. But Matthew chapter 2, again, the visit of the wise men or the Magi, depending on which translation you use. We talked about the fact that what is it that we don't know about these wise men or these Magi?
Exactly where they're from.
We don't know exactly where they're from.
How many they
were. We don't know how many they were. Do we know exactly what their title was or social status?
Magi.
They were Magi or wise men. And so again, we are not focusing on what we don't know, but on what we do know. And really, we kind of covered this last Wednesday. What is the real point about Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 through 12 in terms of the visit of the Magi? What's the key point here? Okay, the fact that they came to worship the Son of God. They came to worship this child who they understand, and they ascribe the title of the King of the Jews. Okay, and they said that we have come to worship him. So that's what we're talking about. If I can get somebody to read then... beginning in verse 7 down through verse 12, Matthew chapter 2, 7 through 12. Randy, and then we'll get to Jared for the next reading.
Matthew 2, 7 through 12. Then Herod secretly called the Magi and determined from them the exact time the star appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and search carefully for the child, and when you have found him, report to me so that I too may come and worship him." After hearing the king, they went their way, and the star, which they had seen in the east, went on before them, until it came and stood over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And coming to the house, they saw the child with Mary his mother, and they fell to the ground and worshipped him. Then, opening their treasures, they presented to him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned by God in a dream not to return to Herod, the Magi left for their own country by another way.
All right. So verse 7, and again, we finished last week by talking about the reaction of Herod, and Herod's reaction was one of what? To the fact that these Magi, these wise men, had come to worship the King of the Jews. Herod reacted how?
He was troubled.
He was troubled. What do we know about his character?
He was a nut.
He was a nut.
He was scared to death.
I think you could throw a lot of psychological terms like a psychopath, a narcissist, again, there were a lot of terms that I'm sorry?
He was a nut.
He was crazy, but violently crazy, again, in terms of his jealousy, his fear, his trepidation that someone would come and take his place. So much so that we talk about the fact that perhaps the worst job description in the world was to be a relative of Herod. Because he distrusted his family perhaps more than anybody.
On that, to be a part of his friend's circle or his family, he had killed a wife. He had killed 3 of his sons.
Oh, yes.
And 2 priests, and who knows who else, just because in his twisted mind he thought that they were something threatening.
Like I said, it was a bad thing to be close to him. Randy?
I was just curious at this. I don't think I've ever heard it studied before, but he's
king here, the title of king was bestowed upon him by the Romans, isn't that right? Was he referred to by the Romans as the king of the Jews?
I don't know that title, so to speak, was ever used for him. But again, he was referred to as being king and over that geographic region. So not of necessarily the Jewish people refers to a race of people, as it were. I don't know that title of king of the Jews was ever ascribed to him. I don't remember. Yeah, it's the region again that he was king of, that he was granted authority over. So not necessarily the race of people, but just it was a geographic aspect to it. So Herod, again, we know that his reaction was one of great jealousy, and then ultimately we're going to read when it was all said and done, he reacted very violently. We talked about the different reactions of the people that we have studied so far, that Herod was one of violent rejection, of animosity, of opposition to Jesus. We talked about the chief priests and the scribes who, when told about Jesus, we aren't told that they had any reaction at all. And, that sometimes is the answer today when we go to people with the gospel of Jesus Christ. It's kind of like I'm drawing a blank, Acts chapter 25, and, go away when I find a more convenient time, I'll call for you. No reaction, putting it off, delaying it. And then we talked about the reaction of Anna. We talked about the reaction of Simeon. We talked about the reaction of the shepherds, of the Magi, which was one of great urgency to worship, to give honor and praise to God. But here again, we're back focusing on Herod. And verse 7 talks about the fact that Herod secretly called the Magi and ascertained from them the time that the star appeared. So again, not wanting to do this in open, doing it secretly, when did this appear, trying to, again, what's he trying to get at? Who is he trying to get at?
He wants to get rid of competition.
Right, exactly. And so, verse 8, it says that he sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and make careful search for the child, and when you have found him, report to me that I may too come and worship him. First of all, are these wise men, these magi, however number they are, did they come to do Herod's bidding?
No.
They have their own purpose, don't they? And as it were, you see Herod trying to, as it were, intercede and say, I have a new mission for you. It's interesting, in terms of shall I obey God or shall I obey men? Ultimately, these wise men, these magi, who did they serve in following the star and going to see the king of the Jews? They serve God. They're not concerned about the orders of the king. And so again, but he tells them, go search for the child. When you find him, report to me that I too may come and worship him. Are there people who worship God today for reasons other than giving God glory and honor and praise? And truly worshiping him. I'm sorry? Yeah, but there are people who worship God for other reasons today, aren't there? Yeah, for financial reasons, for power reasons, for, again, prestige reasons, for other reasons. And so, again, and we know that he doesn't intend to go and worship him. But verse 9 says, and having heard the king, so they heard him, but it's kind of like sometimes talking to each other, talking to members of our family, the old in one ear, out the other. They don't pay any attention to him. Having heard the king, they went on their way. And so they are continuing, and lo, the star which they had seen in the east went on before them until it came and stood over where the child was. Now, back in verse 2, how did they describe this star that they've been following?
His star.
They refer to his star. And again, we talked about the fact that I believe by faith they knew this to be his star. This, and you can read a lot of speculation, there's a lot of junk on the internet. There's a lot of stuff about the Magi, the wise men, many who speculate that they were simply reading the stars. They truly were astrologers, and they were just mapping the stars, and they, you know, there was just some certain alignment of the stars, and that led them to this specific location. But that's not what it says here. It says his star, and that his star went before them and stood over the place where the child was. Do we know how high or what elevation? We don't know that. But it was very clear to these magi, these wise men, that his star was now above where the child was. And they understood that. And I reject the idea that they were, quote, just very good astronomers. That they were just very good at reading the stars, and they determined this is some special, alignment of the stars. No. They understood this was his star, and they followed it, and they followed it until it stood. Again, they're following it, but now this star is standing over where the child was. And so I believe this is a very miraculous star. Well, we're not told that, but again, we talked about last week how that do we see these wise men, these magi, acting by faith? And again, Romans 10:17 says, faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. Do we know how these wise men were told that this was his star, and that it would lead them to the King of the Jews? We don't know.
Yeah, but that would be assumption then.
What?
It would be assumption.
Assumption that they were told it.
Yeah. Well, so as far as I understood, there must have been something that they knew then that we don't know today. I'm sorry, it's very mysterious.
Well, no, there are some very mysterious aspects about this, but what we know is that they knew that this was his star.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Okay.
Yeah, but I'm just saying.
How did they know?
How
did they know it was his star?
We don't know.
We don't know that.
Yeah, exactly.
But did they? I reject that they knew it based on human wisdom. Other than perhaps referring to, I don't know, some scholars point to some prophetic scriptures, and I didn't record those that talk about a star. Whether or not they're using prophecy or whether there was a direct revelation. But again, what I'm saying is I reject the idea that they were simply looking up at the sky and says, oh, look, these two stars are in alignment. That must mean that, no, that they knew it was his star, and you're right, David. We don't know how they came to believe and have faith.
Apparently they knew what they were looking at, what to look for.
Yes. Yeah, yes, they did. And you're right, it is mysterious. And we don't know. But what we know, again, is what I'll camp on is this: they knew that was his star. And they followed it, and they knew that that star, according to verse 2, would lead them to the King of the Jews. And exactly what revelation of God led them to that, you're right, David, we won't know that. Rick?
In verse 12, it says that
right.
So there was some sort of a revelation there. It's like, they might have been warned and told what the star was about previously. It doesn't say when they had the dream.
Right. Well, yeah, we know they had that dream. And so did they have a dream beforehand that told them that this was his star? And again, you're right. And God has spoken to people in dreams. But again, you're right, David. We ultimately don't know. We know that by faith they believe that that was his star, his being the King of the Jews. Randy?
It's also a little bit puzzling that it was revealed to them to follow his star, but then they didn't go straight to the child. They went to Jerusalem and asked the king, where's he who's born King of the Jews? And then he tells them, go to Bethlehem. Star again, and it leads them to it. So it's kind of like, well, they stopped before they got there and asked the king. So, again, it's just a little
puzzle. me just offer one little thing here. Matthew is the gospel about prophecy establishing the kingdom of the Jews, right? We're going to talk just a little bit about a prophecy about Jesus Christ that said he would come out of a certain place, doesn't it?
Egypt.
Out of Egypt. Things had to happen so that he needed to go to Egypt. And again, I think we see God's plan here in terms of them going to Jerusalem to ask for the King of Jews to trouble Herod, to arouse his fears, which ultimately played out in his killing of all the babies, which required, again, Joseph being warned in a dream to go to where? Egypt. All I know is, again, we see the unfolding of God's scheme, God's plan, God's fulfillment of all his prophecies. And do we know exactly how all of these things, again, you know, there's, as David said, a lot of unknown aspects to this. But I think, again, we need to go back to the points where we know. And what we know about them, that we know that these wise men, these magi, were following his star. They knew about the King of the Jews. Again, it was led them to Jerusalem, where they asked Herod and determined to go to Bethlehem. And, yeah, a lot of different aspects of this.
Which translation says his star? Mine says the star.
New American Standard. American Standard. And I believe, again, I think that's the Greek text that refers to his star.
In verse 2.
Right, yeah. Verse 2. Right. And verse 10 is the star also. Okay. So, and again, any other comments before we move on from here? Okay. So, we talked in verse 9, that this star, his star, came and stood over where the child was. And when they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. That's kind of one of those double superlatives. Can you imagine, again, the being one of these wise men, however many they were? We don't know how far they've come, but it more than likely was not just a couple of miles. More than likely was quite a trip, quite a journey. They've been following the star. They've gone to Jerusalem. They've been pointing to Bethlehem. They followed the star until it finally stood over where the child was. Can you imagine the joy? Exceeding great joy. Randy?
I guess based on verse 12, having been warned by God to bring not to Herod. And of course, they're obedient to that. So that kind of clues you in that these men knew who God was, and the overwhelming sense of joy came from the fact that we get to worship God robed in flesh. That's never happened before. You've never, ever been able to worship someone on the earth and be righteous. From the history of the world, the only one you can worship righteously is the one in heaven. Here, for the first time ever in the history of the world, they're going to worship somebody who's in flesh. And it's obviously been revealed to them that this is God. This little baby is God. And that's why they're worshiping. That's overwhelming.
Well, right. I can only imagine. And again, if we had gone on such a journey of faith, and again, when it finally comes to conclusion that you've acted upon, how joyous that must be. So you had your hand up earlier.
I was just in regards to what Randy was saying about why they went to Jerusalem first. It says that they told Herod that he saw his star in the east and have come to worship him. Not that they followed the star there. It explicitly says later that they followed the star to where Jesus was. So making me wonder that they saw the star and knew what that meant and then came to Jerusalem because they knew that that's a proxy
Okay, very good. But again, it was God who led them there. And again, God who showed this star, his star to them, absolutely. They rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And then, as we made the point, verse 11, they came into what? They came into the house. And they worship him. And we talked about, again, all that we talk about, verses 1 through 12 here, let's remember that. You know, that's what we know. They came to worship him. They came to give honor and, again, ascribe deity to this child and worship him as such. And when they saw the child with Mary, his mother, they fell down and worshiped him. And again, it says, and then opening their treasures, they presented to him gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh. The gifts, again, customary in that time in that time and in times before that, when you went to visit a king, what was it proper to do? To bring gifts. If you look at Isaiah chapter 60 and verses 1 through 6, Jared, could you read that for us? Isaiah 60, 1 through 6. So, again, I think we see a messianic prophecy here in terms of bringing gifts unto the Messiah, unto the promised one. Can anybody think about an example in the Old Testament of when someone brought gifts to a king? I'm sorry, who said that? Very good. Very good. The Queen of Sheba brought gifts to King... Very good. Excellent. The Queen of Sheba brought gifts to Solomon. Absolutely. So, any other examples you can think of? I mean, that's a good one to remember. But that was customary at that time to give honor to a king. And we see here that they brought unto him, again, gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And again, we talked about where does the tradition of three magi or wise men come from? Well, often it comes from the fact that it says gold, frankincense, and myrrh. But does it even say that there were only three gifts? No. It just says gifts of these items. And so it could have been any number of gifts. But it was gifts of three different items. And we'll talk in just a minute about what those items are. But again, just suffice it for now, these are very valuable items, aren't they? And it was pointed out, and someone pointed out that they offered to him, to Jesus, the things which were most esteemed among themselves. That is, that they brought the best of what they could. That this wasn't, let me see what I've got left over in my garage. Let me see just, you know, what trinkets I may have. They brought the best of what they have to the Lord. And we'll talk about how valuable these things were. The feeling of these devout givers are to be seen in the richness of their gifts. This one commentator points out that do we see the reflection in our heart in terms of what we offer to the Lord? So the application of this would be, what do we bring to our King? In our efforts to worship God, to give honor to Him, we talked about the fact that it's customary to bring gifts to our King. And isn't it a thought-provoking question to ask ourselves, what have I brought to my King? What have I presented to Him as a token of my value? Have I brought the best of what I have to the Lord? Bruce? Would you sound? Romans 12, 1 and 2, you want to read that for us? Okay, go on to verse 2.
And do not be conformed to this world, but transformed by the renewing of mind, so that you may prove that what the will of God is, and that which is good, acceptable, and perfect.
So when it comes to what we present as a gift to our King, what does that context tell us that ultimately God is looking for us to present to Him? Our lives, our very selves. Okay, and that manifested in terms of, again, our urgency to offer our worship unto God. Absolutely. I mean, there's manifestations of someone who has given their life, you know, as a living sacrifice. Do you remember in 2 Corinthians chapter 8, when Paul is talking about the collection for the needy saints in Jerusalem? That he's talking about the brethren in Macedonia, the churches in Macedonia, how abundantly they gave in terms of helping the needy saints in Jerusalem. And he talked about how that they actually gave beyond their ability. Remember that? In verses 3 and 4, they gave beyond their means. And it's like, well, how could they give beyond their means to people they've never met before? How do you get to that point in your life when you're going to give more than what you've got to give to people you've never met? And in verse 5, I think it indicates, and it's an example of what Bruce is talking about in Romans 12, verses 1 and 2, where it says, "And this, not as we had expected, but they first gave themselves to the Lord and to us by the will of God." How is it that you get to the point where you say, I'll give more than I can give, and I'll give it to people I've never met because I trust that they're my brethren, And that I want to offer myself as a living sacrifice because they gave themselves to the Lord. And so I think it's an application of Romans chapter 12 and verses 1 and 2. But do we find ourselves sometimes, do we all face the temptation to not give the very best that we have to the Lord? Do we find ourselves perhaps like those in Malachi's day, in terms of that we're giving the leftovers to God? And again, it's not a matter of leftover lambs that we're giving to God, but what are the leftovers that we're tempted to give to God? Leftover what? Leftover time. That I'll take care of my job, I'll take care of my recreation, I'll take care of my hobbies, I'll take care of my family, I'll take care of my sleep, I'll take care of my TV, and if I have time left over, I'll give that to God. What's another thing we're tempted to give leftovers to God of?
Now, another thing, a good example, like Ellen and Sapphira, Ellen Miles and Sapphira. Okay, they had, now they're supposed to sell their land and all of this. And they didn't think when they sold their land, they took their part off first. You're not supposed to take out, you're supposed to take God's part off first. He come first. But they stole, in other words, like, they took the first part and tried to give God the leftovers.
Well,
and when they came in when they came in and tried to give up their property, what they had, they lied about.
They lied. That's, they lied. That'll get you in trouble, won't it?
They had both of them dropped dead.
Right. Yeah.
God had played. And
okay.
On
teenagers many years ago. We were talking about Matthew 6:33, seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. And I asked him, how can we really see if we're seeking God and his kingdom first? What's something we can look at to kind of see that? Is it just a check mark to say yes, or is there something we can look at? And after a few minutes of thinking about it, this group of teenagers came back and said, you know, there's two things we can look at. We could look at how you spend your time. We could look at how you spend your blessings. That's a pretty astute answer in terms of what we're truly putting first in our lives and what we're presenting to God as to whether it's the best of what we have to give. Bruce?
Well, Ephesians chapter 5, you know, verse 17 says, so, you know, do not be foolish, but understand what God is. And do not be drunk with wine.
So, again, do you think it's an interesting question? Go ahead, Randy.
I was just kidding. I guess we're right on the same track here, but this verse is a parallel to Romans 12:1-2. Deuteronomy chapter 10, verse 12. Moses talking, he says, now Israel, what does the Lord your God require from you? But to fear the Lord your God, and to walk in all his ways and love him, and to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to keep all his commandments and his statutes which I have commanded you. Ultimately, what we bring to our king is our obedience.
It's our lives. It's who we are. 2 Corinthians 12? Yes, 2 Corinthians 12:15. What did Paul say, Mickey, in terms of what he was going to do for God?
He's glad to stand and be spent.
Is that the living sacrifice that he was talking about?
Someone told me a long time ago that it's generally those who are willing to be spent who are also willing to spend.
Well, you can't separate them. Yeah. So I think that passage in terms of Paul's giving his best to God, he says, I'll spend myself, I'll spend my life, I'll spend who I am for your sake and for the Lord's sake.
Where's that?
2 Corinthians 12:15. I'll most gladly spend and be spent. So... but I think as we reflect upon these magi, however many they were in terms of what they brought to the king, things very valuable. They brought the best of what they had. Again, what do we bring to our king? And can anybody, when I thought about this, you know, bringing gifts to the king, can anybody think of a song that we sing that talks about how that God has blessed us and ask the question, what gifts do we bring to him? Song, I gave my life for thee, which in the closing verse says, speaking the words of Jesus, I bring rich gifts to thee, what hast thou brought to me? And that idea of, again, God has sent his son, Jesus came and he gave his life. The question is, what gifts then do we bring to our king? And I think that's answered by what we've talked about. So, any other thoughts in general about the gifts that we bring to our king? Let's talk a little bit in particular about what those gifts are. Again, the first gift being gold. Do anybody need a definition of gold? Okay, we understand that. How about frankincense? Anybody know what frankincense is?
Well, the word incense is in it,
but it's actually incense. Okay, yes, it's right. It's a white resin or gummy substance, and again, very fragrant when burned, used in worship as incense and in sacrificial offerings, something found in Arabia. Denise?
I also read that it's good for arthritis.
And there are no doubt there are some, with these last two items, some medicinal benefits to them. Yes, I've read something about that too. Haven't tried it. And we'll see if I need to. And the last thing, myrrh. What is myrrh? I'm sorry? Okay, absolutely. It's also both frankincense and myrrh come from a tree. It is very bitter. And as Carolyn pointed out, it was normally, especially back then, I don't know anything about it today. I don't know if it's part of the embalming process today, but it was back then very common to use myrrh in the embalming process. And interestingly enough, John chapter 19, in fact, who was buried with myrrh? Jesus was. Can somebody read for us verses 39 through 41? John chapter 19.
39?
Yes.
And there came also Nicodemus, he who at the first came to him by night, bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pounds. So they took the body of Jesus and bound it in linen cloths with the spices, as the custom of the Jews is to bury.
Okay. So again, we see that's as Carolyn pointed out, that's the common burial practice of the day. There was another aspect to myrrh in the death of Christ. Do you remember? And that's the reference of Mark 15:23. What is it that myrrh had to do with Jesus before he died? Mark 15:23. And again, what do we say that myrrh is very what? Very bitter. Would not have tasted very good at all. Interestingly enough, also, I cite up there Esther chapter 2 and verse 12. Esther chapter 2, what's happening in that chapter in the book of Esther? Anybody? What happened in chapter 1? Vashti was disposed of as queen, and they're now in the king was now in the process of looking for a queen, and there were a number of women brought to, as it were, the king's palace, and all these women were put through a process of
purification,
beautification, as it were, and we read then in Esther chapter 2 and verse 12 that part of this beautification, this purification, included the fact it says, "Now when the turn of each young lady came to go into King Ahasuerus, after the end of her 12 months under the regulations for the women, for the days of their beautification were completed as follows, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and the cosmetics for women." So it's interesting that, again, it was even used in terms of, again, as it were, a cosmetic, beauty process, as it were. Again, we've kind of answered this already. Any parallels you see in these gifts, or any, as it were, foreshadowing of these gifts regarding Christ? Expensive, yes. Let's talk a little bit about, again, that's the bottom line, is they brought their best. But, and just real quick, I was going to share with you, because I was curious, I didn't know what, I was going to say, I don't know what gold, frankincense, and myrrh look like. I know what gold looks like. But obviously gold on your right, frankincense in the middle, and myrrh. Left to right, myrrh on the right. The interesting thing is that these were brought to honor the king. Not only were they very valuable in and of themselves, but again, I was taught it's how you present it. Some have speculated that, again, they were not just brought in a gunny sack or something like that, but more than likely would have been presented very, very formally to the king and in some type of receptacle appropriate for those. And we have no idea that this is, you know, what they would have looked at like at the time. But, you know, they just didn't bring them in a grocery paper sack, as it were, and drop them before them. But regarding these gifts, some think that these three gifts were chosen for some symbolism, as it were. I'm not going to argue this point, but obviously gold, obviously, we know throughout Old Testament scriptures, represented royalty. I mean, it was something kings were normally associated with. We talked about the fact that frankincense was part of incense, and incense was used in what? worship to God. And so could you say that frankincense is a symbol of his priestly role, of his divinity, of someone worthy of worship? That, again, frankincense being an object or part of worship unto God. And then finally, as we already noted, myrrh, perhaps prefiguring his death, his embalming, and indicating his humanity. To Denise's point, there were some who would argue, saying, well, there were some practical purposes, you know, to these gifts that were meant to help Mary and Joseph, that were meant to provide, you know, the financial means that they need. Again, a lot of speculation there. I don't think it had to do with a practical purpose that they brought these, because it says they came to worship him. And I take these as simply objects of worship, and that they, again, brought their best. And again, let's leave it at this. All we know is that they intended to worship him. And in doing so, they brought very valuable gifts unto him, the best of what they could bring to the King of the Jews. Any other comments then about these gifts, about the Magi, about them coming to worship the King of the Jews? Mickey?
Just a thought. When we look at these passages that indicate worship and praise, whether it be what we noted earlier about Zacharias or Simon, and who they recognize God is, who they recognize that God has sent, and the purpose for which he came, I'm not convinced that there's any reason at all for us to doubt the knowledge of these Magi. They're described as wise men. Of course, we don't know a whole lot more about who they were. It says that they were from the east. There is perhaps some idea that they were from the Gentile world. Perhaps so. What I'm trying to say is I don't want us to come away with the understanding that God had not communicated anything about the wonders of his son and the salvation that his son came to offer to those who were not Jews. He did. We see that prior to even the existence of such a thing as a Jew. And now here these Magi, they came and they obviously know who he is. They know what he's come to provide. And they come to worship him. I think that's a remarkable thing to take home about who these guys were.
They ascribed the honor due to the Son of God.
Yes.
And again, exactly what their full breadth of knowledge was, we don't know, but they knew enough that this was the one whom God had sent that we need to worship. And they came a long ways, and they brought a lot. They brought the best they had. And again, I think some application for us in terms of how far are we willing to go to worship him, and how willing are we to give the best of what we have to the Lord? And then finally, verse 12. What were they told then about it? It's they've come, they've offered their worship, they've offered their gifts to the Lord. It's time to go home. And they're simply told what in a dream? Okay, go another way. It just dawned on me now. You remember the old prophet, or the man of God, and is that early in 1 Kings, I want to say, that was told to go home another way. Jonathan?
Oh, 1 Kings 2.
2, I think, yeah. Interesting, and the old prophet who met him and said, no, I've been told you don't have to go home another way. Everything that is indicated here is that, what do we probably know about these wise men? They probably obeyed and went home another way. We know they did not go back home by way of Herod, because eventually Herod figures out that his little scheme had not worked. So they were warned in a dream. God communicated to them directly of the need to go another way, which they did. All right, in just a couple minutes that we have left, let's take a look at verses 13 through 15. Verses 13 through 15, James, could you read those verses for us?
Now when they were departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeareth to Joseph in a dream, saying, arise and take the young child and his mother, and flee into Egypt, and be thou there until I tell thee, for Herod will seek the young child to destroy him. And he arose and took the young child and his mother by night, and departed into Egypt, and was there until the death of Herod, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the Lord through the prophet, saying, "Out of Egypt did I call my son."
Again, who is working here in every turn of events as we go along? God is. God is working his plan. He's working his scheme. And again, he knows the prophecies that need to be fulfilled in his son. And he knows in the time in which, you know, his son will ultimately present his life as a sacrifice upon the cross. But again, his son has just come. Now is not the time. Is God going to allow his son's life to be taken at this point in time? No. And so in a dream, he warns Joseph that you need to arise and take the child and flee to Egypt. Get up, flee to Egypt, and remain there until I tell you, because Herod seeks to destroy the child. Again, the word for flee... The word for flee literally means to run away, to vanish, to seek safety by flight. Again, literally what the angel, what Joseph is being told in his dream by the angel of the Lord. You need to run away, you need to vanish, you need to seek safety by flight. But what we need to note what he was not told. The angel did not say when you get up in the morning or at the end of the week or as soon as it's convenient. What was notable about the timing of this command?
You bail out now.
Do it. Flee. And in terms of when God says to do something and there's not a time in the future to do it, when does God intend for us to obey that command? Now. And we don't know. It could have been the next day that Herod began the process of doing what he was going to do with the male children. But the angel of the Lord told Joseph to get up, flee to Egypt, and remain there. And what does it say that Joseph did? Verse 14, when? Okay, so again, he took him while it was still night. There wasn't a... And again, were all the facts kind of filled in here in terms of did he have a full itinerary? Did he know exactly, flee to Egypt? Where do I go? You know, what do I do? How long am I going to stay there? A lot of questions, perhaps. If we were going on a trip, wouldn't we want to know some of the details? And is Joseph told all those things in this dream? But did that stop him from getting up in the middle of the night and leaving as he had been told? Randy?
The very first thing the angel said in the dream was, get up. The very first thing he said,
right.
Get up. Take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt. Get in bed. Let's discuss this for a while.
Right. And verse 14 says he did what?
He got up.
He arose. He took the child. And his mother by night and departed for Egypt. So again, we see we can talk next week in terms of the urgency of obeying what God has told us to do. Again, Acts 22:16, what was Saul of Tarsus told? Or what was he asked?
Why are you delaying?
Why are you putting this off? Why do you tarry? And so in terms of anything that God has asked us to do, again, the message to us is, what are you waiting for? Yeah. All right. We will pick this up. I'm fairly confident we will finish the context of lesson number 2. There are still more lesson sheets on the front bench up here if you do not have that. And again, because I would anticipate perhaps next week we will begin going over the questions. After we talk about Jesus and his return from Egypt and when he settled in Nazareth, and we're going to go jump all the way from somewhere in his first 2 years all the way up to his 12-year point in time next week.